the Honorable Justice Cherry presiding.
Well, good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Okay, why am I echoing? Okay. Our first case this morning is case number 55948, Gary Rosales versus Rosales versus State. Mr. Petty for the appellant, Mr. Platter for the respondent.
Good morning, Justices. Good morning, Counsel. My name is John Petty. I'm with the Washoe County Public Defender's Office, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the appellant, Gary Rosales. I'd like to reserve, and I have reserved, 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Briefly, following his arrest in Whitaker, California, Mr. Rosales was charged with 7 counts of discharging a firearm into an occupied structure, 1 count of attempted murder, 1 count of aggravated stalking of the Washoe County District Attorney, and 1 count of criminal anarchy. On appeal, Mr. Rosales has challenged each of these convictions on various grounds. For example, with regards to the attempted murder, Mr. Rosales argues that the state proved at best implied malice, not expressed malice, and therefore under this court's decision in Keyes v. State, the conviction for attempted murder is doomed and invalidated, and we ask that it be reversed on that basis, that it was only implied malice proven at trial below. But what I want to focus this court's attention on this morning, obviously, is the criminal anarchy statute, because it's a very unique statute.
Actually, it's not that unique. It's quite similar to New York's old statute, correct?
Well, I misspoke when I said unique. It's an interesting statute for purposes of this particular case.
Fair enough.
All right.
The question I have out of the chute on that, because I agree with you, I think your argument presents serious questions as to the constitutionality of that statute facially and as applied. The question I have is, was this presented in any way, shape, or form in the district court first, and secondly, did you give notice to the clerk to give notice to the attorney general that the constitutionality of this statute was put in question here?
The answer to the first question, was it litigated in any fashion below prior to trial before Judge Flanagan? No. With regards, did I give notice to this to the court clerk to notify the attorney general? I did not. And I apologize for that. I did not. I think, however, the court can still consider the statute, if not in the context of its constitutionality, and in fact, I'm going to make an argument that will allow you to grant relief to my client, which is a reversal of the conviction, without having to reach the constitutionality of the statute, although I would like to comment upon it a little bit, if I may.
Yeah, the statute's very troubling under Brandenburg.
Yeah. I did not give notice to the district attorney, to the attorney general's office, but I think you can still approach the statute from the context of, does the statute even apply to the facts of this particular case? Because if you decide that this was simply a matter of the district attorney's office overreaching, the prosecutor overreaching and charging Mr. Rosales with this statute, then the court can reverse Mr. Rosales' conviction on that basis and never get to the constitutional issues. But as I said, in my time here, I would like to at least address them briefly for the court's consideration if it wants to resolve this issue on a constitutional analysis. But let's look at the facts first so that we can determine whether or not the statute even applies. These facts, the operative facts, are essentially this, that between 1999 and 2004, graffiti was placed in the southern part of Reno on buildings, on fences, and at least at one point the side of an 18-wheeler truck, I believe. And I have provided the court a copy of the trial exhibits that were introduced. In Volume 6 of the Joint Appendix, I reproduced all of the photographs of the graffiti that was introduced at trial, as trial evidence by the state. And when you look at that stuff, you'll notice that it is crude, it is rude, it's juvenile, it's disgusting, but that does not make it without First Amendment protection. It's axiomatic that the First Amendment protects not only the gentile and the enlightened and the tasteful, but much of everything else. In Texas v. Johnson, the court said that if there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it is that the government may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds the idea offensive. And more recently, in fact, June of this year, Justice Scalia, speaking for the court in Brown versus Entertainment Merchants Association, said that disgust is not a valid basis for restricting expression. But the issue that this court has to decide first is, does the statute even apply? NRS 203-1151 defines criminal anarchy and defines it as such, that it is the doctrine that organized government should be overthrown by force or violence or by assassination of the executive head or any of the executive officials of government or by any unlawful means. We take a little historical footnote for a moment. Our statute, as Justice Pickering mentioned earlier this morning, is modeled after a statute that was enacted in New York in 1902 following the assassination of President McKinley in 1901 by an avowed anarchist by the name of Leon Sigolsky. Like that statute, our statute in subsection 2 makes certain conduct and speech, words, unlawful. Subsection 2A and B of the statute makes it unlawful to advocate, advise, or teach by word or mouth or writing the duty, necessity, or propriety of overthrowing organized government by force or violence, including the assassination of the executive head or any executive head of government.
Read literally, that would have outlawed the Declaration of Independence.
Literally, it would have. Subsection 2C makes it unlawful to openly justify the assassination of an executive official of the United States, a state, or some civilized nation for the purpose of advocating criminal anarchy. As I indicated in Volume 6, I've given you the photographs of the graffiti, and I asked to look through each of those photographs as, in some respects, vulgar and disgusting as they may be, and in some other respects, how silly they might be, to determine whether or not there is anything in there that calls for the overthrow of organized government or teaches the propriety of the doctrine of criminal anarchy, and you will find none. What you find is anti-police screeds such as kill cops, cops must die, kids must be taught to kill cops, Dick Gamick must die, I will kill Dick Gamick, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Tom Barb, the prosecutor below, didn't even tie this graffiti to the concept of overthrowing the government. As I said, he merely argued that it was anti-police greed, sort of hate cop speech. We don't need these lousy cops. In fact, his full argument consists of two paragraphs of Volume 5 of the Joint Appendix at page 559 and 560. That kind of speech, hate cop speech, is protected by the First Amendment. In Wood v. Georgia, the Supreme Court said that criticism of people involved in the investigation and prosecution of crime is protected by the First Amendment. Watts v. United States recognized that sometimes this language can be vituperative, it can be abusive, and it can be inexact, which is what we have here. In any event, it is protected speech, and he did not breach the statute because nothing in these writings calls for the overthrow of organized government or teaches the propriety of the doctrine of criminal anarchy. So as I said, if this court agrees with me that the statute simply does not apply to these facts, that the prosecution overreached in prosecuting him under the statute, then the court can reverse the conviction on that basis and need not ever reach the constitutional issue. But if the court wants to reach the constitutional issue, let me give you my ideas just briefly on that. And that is simply this. We attack the statute first as unconstitutional as written. And we argue that there is no set of circumstances under which this statute could be valid as written. And that's the lesson that we learned from People v. Epton, which is the New York Court of Appeals case from 1967, where the New York Court of Appeals revisited their criminal anarchy statute, which had previously been upheld by the Supreme Court in Gitlow v. New York in 1925. But in 1967, having reviewed the ensuing development of First Amendment jurisprudence by the United States Supreme Court, the court in People v. Epton said, our statute is unconstitutional as written, because it...
They substantially revised it.
Well, what they did is they found that the statute as written was unconstitutional because the prescription of mere advocacy of the violent overthrow of government would be an unconstitutional infringement upon speech under Dennis v. United States. That's from People v. Epton. But what two of the justices in that court did, there was one justice who dissented, Justice Burke, was they said, we can save the statute if we read into the statute a constitutional requirement that there be a clear and present danger with regards to the advocacy. And that's how they say that statute. And I might note, this court, too, has done statute-saving readings. Most recently, last September in 4 v. State, where this court said we can read in a specific intent element to Nevada's pandering statute. So judicial construction, judicial interpretation of the statute that reads a element into the statute is appropriate. This court has done it. Brandenburg v. Ohio is a case where that, in fact, was done. And we'll get to that in a, minute. So this court can do that. Of course, since 1967 to today's date, the test has changed. It's no longer the clear and present danger test. It is the imminent lawlessness test of Brandenburg v. Ohio. And we submit, in fact, that particular test can be stated from my note here. That test is: a state may not forbid or prescribe advocacy of the use of force or of law violation except when such advocacy is directed to inciting or producing imminent lawlessness and is likely to incite or produce such action. So as relevant here, the state would have had to approve not just that the graffiti advocated the use of force or violence or violation of law, but that such advocacy was directed to inciting or producing imminent lawlessness action and was likely to produce. What we have here is, over a span of time, graffiti placed at various locations around southern Reno. It wasn't as if this individual was in a crowd inciting a crowd. It wasn't as if anybody took the writing seriously, because nothing happened. Nothing flowed from the words that were placed on these various locations. And there is a temporal element. And if you look at post-Brandenburg cases in this regard, and in that regard, cases such as Hess v. Indiana, 414 U.S. 105, a 1973 case, where a fellow was arrested during demonstrations for basically saying, while the police were clearing the street, "We'll take back that effing street later." And the Supreme Court said, you know, at best, it might have been a counsel for present moderation. At worst, it amounted to nothing more than advocacy of illegal action at some indefinite future time. That's at page 108 of volume 414 of the United States reports. The NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware Company, where the court reasoned that when a few weeks had separated potentially incendiary speeches from violent reaction, the speech did not present the actionable threat. So there has to be a connection, there has to be a tie between the words that are being spoken and an immediate kind of result.
The question I have, and I'm cutting into your time, so I'm going to ask that he have some extra time. In Ford, the specific intent requirement was at least moored in the language of the statute and the common law as well, and the unique criminal requirements of act and intent producing a criminal result. I'm a little troubled about, and I understand in Epton, because they had Gitlow upholding that statute, why they would have gone the direction they did, because they were caught sort of between a rock and a hard place. But what I'm interested in hearing from both counsel on is whether saving this statute by construction is appropriate in light of its pretty bare language and importing into it judicially required terms that are simply not there. And at some point, you have to say this statute does not satisfy constitutional mandate. And so the debate I'm interested in is, where is this an appropriate case to narrow this statute's application? I don't know.
That's a very good question, and my answer is this, is that this court can simply say, based on the language of the statute,
that it doesn't apply,
that it is unconstitutional, and we need not save it. And that would be an appropriate action by this court. I had simply suggested, following the model of Epton, that if the court thought otherwise and felt, you know, we've got to do something to try and save the statute, then the only way you can do it is by reading the Brandenburg the Ohio imminent lawlessness test into it as an element of the offense. That is the only way you can do it. I'm not saying that you must do that. In fact, if this court were inclined to say this statute is unconstitutional on its face and we invalidate it as such under the First Amendment and Article 1, Section 9 of the Nevada Constitution, which is coextensive, so be it. Either way, my client's conviction should be reversed. I'll submit the other issues on the briefs. Thank
we'll
you.
Give you some extra time. For the state?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Plater for the state of Nevada. Justice Pickering, I think I'd like to go first to your concern about the statute. What do we do with the Brandenburg requirement that the action has to incite or actually produce imminent unlawful action? And if you read the statute, we're talking about NRS 203.115 generally, then specifically subsection 2, we find that there is no express provision for the Brandenburg standard in the statute. That's clear. So we could do one of three things. You could declare the statute unconstitutional on its face because the Brandenburg standard is not there. Secondly, you could read the Brandenburg standard into the statute like the court did in New York and Epton. Third, you could read the language of the statute and construe the language as it's presently stated in the statute or the standard of Brandenburg. And you would do it like this. If you look at NRS 203.1152A, that statute prohibits anyone from advocating, advising, or teaching anarchy by assassination or unlawful means. So the argument would be that under Brandenburg, there has to be speech that's likely to incite or produce imminent lawless action. So you can meet the Brandenburg statute of regulating speech under the First Amendment if someone has likely incited lawless action or has produced imminent lawless action. So looking at 203.115.2A, where it prohibits advocating, advising, teaching anarchy by one of those means, our argument would be that since inciting means to provoke or stir up, and advocacy or advising or teaching is essentially the equivalent of provoking, that therefore advocacy or advising under the statute is the equivalent of inciting unlawful action.
So you're saying that advise is a synonym for
right.
incite?
Right. Yeah, you could take one of those terms, advising.
And teach is inciting?
It could be, the court can can put the constitutional construction on those terms that they must essentially be inciting in order to successfully prosecute somebody under the statute.
Okay, if we do that, are you done with your thought there?
Right, yes.
If we do that, then how does that construction apply to the graffiti? And the court does have exhibit or appendix volume 6 on the bench. So walk us through how that would apply to these pictures of graffiti or tags.
Okay. So again, going back to the statute, NRS 203.1152A, that prohibits the advocacy of overthrowing government by one of three ways: force or violence, the assassination of any executive official, or by any unlawful means. So what we proved in this case, in terms of what Mr. Rosales did, is that he wrote a number of things, and he used graffiti, and he used his own actions to create this atmosphere of incitement. He threatened the life of the district attorney, Mr. Gamick. He threatened the life of police officers. He threatened the life of the police officers' wives, and essentially through his graffiti told the public to assault the wives of those police officers. Some of the things that he said were said in the present tense and provoked or urged people to follow through on these actions. He said, for example, not only will I quote I will kill Dick Gamek, end quote. He told other people to, quote, kill Gamek now, quote. Quote, Dick Gamek must be killed now, end quote. He told people in some vile and disturbing, explicit ways how to kill female police officers. He offered rewards for killing police officers, up to $5,000. He listed the license plate number and patrol number, numbers of the police cars in the community. And in one of his graffiti rantings, he said, quote, commit murder on these punk-ass cops, end quote. He advocated, or he praised the deaths of certain police officers, specifically Officer Bohatch and Officer Schofield.
And K-9 unit.
Excuse me?
And the K-9 unit, Becco.
Right. He specifically mentioned Jerry Hoover and Jim Weston, that they, quote, must die, end quote. He said, quote, cops, kill cops tonight, end quote. Sodomize cops' sons after the murder of the cops. In one piece of graffiti, he said that Officers Weston, Hoover, and Wignanski, dash, quote, shoot these cops.
Did he ever advocate killing police dogs, or did, because I know he talked about the canine unit, and did that, I wasn't sure about that in the record. There was some kind of passing reference to that. So is that advocated as well? Did not come up.
Well, that can be read that way. There is a piece of graffiti where the canine brigade is mentioned as part of being killed with certain officers. So, what
I understand the threats. So many of these declarations appeared to be his, either reciting what he'd done in the past or declaring his present intention personally to do something in the future. So, but you're relying on, for criminal anarchy, the ones that are of the vein, like 1B, kill Gamek now, 1C, Dick Gamek must be killed now.
Yes, that's part of it. And, also his provoking or urging the community to kill police officers, any names, specific officers by name. Hoover, Weston, Wignanski, and he praised the death of certain other officers such as Bohatch and Schofield. He offered, as I said, $5,000 rewards for the killing of these officers. This is the type of...
Where's the which one is the $5,000 reward one?
I don't think it's in Volume 6 that was referred to by Mr. Petty. That was cited in my brief, though, Your Honor. The record, on appeal, well, I can't find it right now, but I know I have a specific cite to the record on appeal for that assertion about rewards would be offered up to $5,000.
We'll look for it. I could not find it, but that's not...
It is mentioned in my brief, and I think I'm pretty sure that there's a specific cite to that. It is in the record on appeal in any event. So what Mr. Rosales is doing in this graffiti is that he's urging the actual and present killing of government officials, such as police officers and Mr. Gamek. Now, he never uses the phrase in his graffiti, overthrow the government, or do this in order to produce criminal anarchy. But what he's advocating constitutes criminal anarchy, so that if somebody followed the actions or the things that he's suggesting, the result would be criminal anarchy, and it would, in essence, be the overthrow of government if people did what he urged them to do. As to the idea that this was not an imminent consequence, or would not have been a consequence that would have flowed recent in time to, in relation to the graffiti that he painted, We have two arguments. The first is that whenever somebody like Mr. Rosales advocates the present violation of the criminal code in whatever fashion, and he's asking people to do that, that in and of itself, that expression is essentially conduct, and that the conduct is imminent, absent any other extreme or unforeseen circumstance. So, in other words, if you had a small child or somebody who didn't have all of his faculties about him, and it was apparent, and he went on some rant and was asking the community to commit illegal acts, we probably wouldn't say that the acts were imminent, because it's just not realistic. It's not a rational consequence of what he's saying. But where we see graffiti like this over a period of time, asking the community to conduct or to perform specific criminal acts, and where the person himself actually commits violent criminal acts in the community, such as shooting Ms. Urquilla and shooting into the homes, the private residences of individuals, when you combine his speech and his conduct, there's no reason to assume that what he's asking the community to do would not be an imminent consequence of the graffiti. So, in essence, when you have a situation like this, there might be a presumption that what he's asking to do, the criminal conduct, will be imminent. The other argument, and it's a little more difficult.
But it can't be imminent at his own hand for it to be
exactly
under the statute. It
right.
has to be inciting someone else.
Right, right. But the fact he's doing these things, and then I might also add something.
And he's leading by example?
Absolutely. And he also refers to his own criminal violent conduct in his graffiti as well, because some of the graffiti said, I'm the one that did the Kitsky Lane shooting when he shot and hit Ms. Urquilla. And he referred to some of those things when he called Dick Gamnick up on the telephone as well. The other argument about meeting the imminent requirement for the Brandenburg statute is a little more involved, and that is that the requirement that the expression be imminent would only apply to crimes that actually occur, that are actually produced under the Brandenburg statute. Because, well, let's go back to the standard. The standard is that certain words or expressions are not protected if they are likely to incite or produce imminent lawless action. So our argument is that the term imminent would only apply to lawless action that is actually occurs or is produced. It does not apply to expressions that are likely to incite. And the reason is that when you speech that can produce criminal conduct, which is not inciting, is pretty rare. And when, so you need a little more justification under the First Amendment to protect or to justify restricting speech like that. If you incite speech, then it's, if you don't have any particular action or criminal conduct that flows from that, then it might be more like advocacy, abstract teaching. And so you need more justification under the First Amendment to prohibit that type of conduct. So it doesn't necessarily have to be imminent if it's likely to produce lawless action.
And you think these facts qualify under that test?
I think it's a jury could have found beyond a reasonable doubt that what he did was inciting, was urging or provoking the community to lawless action. And that's what they indeed found. Now, as to the murder conviction that Mr. Petty referred to, it is the state of the law in Nevada that for an attempted murder to occur, that there has to be expressed malice. But this court has held that the use of a deadly weapon in a couple of cases is certainly evidence that a jury can rely on beyond a reasonable doubt to satisfy the express malice requirement. So in sum, in this case, Mr. Rosales clearly through a number of years in widespread graffiti in Southwest Reno told the public that they should kill police officers, they should kill Mr. Gammack. Those are specific criminal acts, and he told the public how to kill certain female officers in very specific terms. Now, while he may have been a troubled man, and we don't know exactly what his intent was or what he wanted the public to do, he certainly was inciting that type of criminal conduct. When you advocate specific criminal conduct like that in violation of clear criminal codes, then he is in essence advocating the overthrow of government, criminal anarchy. So the statute is clear. We don't think it's overbroad in that respect. The constitutional requirements can be read into it by this court in one of two ways. And so the court should uphold his conviction. Thank you.
May I ask a couple of questions?
Sure, absolutely.
Could you comment on Mr. Petty's argument that notwithstanding the fact this was not raised as a constitutional challenge in the district court, and notwithstanding the fact that notice wasn't given to the AG, that we should go ahead and consider the constitutional issues? Is there any way not to in this case?
Well, our first argument, of course, was that he had waived this argument because he hadn't raised it in the lower court. And we cite a number of jurisdictions that will not consider the constitutionality of a statute on direct appeal. And there are a couple of reasons. One is just the orderly administration of justice requires that you follow the rules, that you present the issue in the lower court so that this court has something to review. This court reviews legal questions that have been first determined by, unless there's de novo review, but even with de novo review, this court reviews orders of a lower court. That's where the direction of this court comes from. If you want to do an as-applied analysis, then you should leave that to the district court because that often involves questions of fact as to what exactly the defendant did and how that conduct is being viewed in terms of the statute that's being applied to it. Now, the argument that there's insufficient evidence and that you can still review the statute as applies to the evidence in this case, that's really a sufficiency of the evidence argument. It's not an argument that the statute is unconstitutional. But that would just go back to my argument that we showed, even though he didn't explicitly put in his graffiti that I want to overthrow the government or somebody should commit criminal anarchy, what he did, if followed, would lead to that result. So if he only advocate the means that lead up to the result, then that constitutes criminal anarchy. And in essence, he's advocating the overthrowing of government.
Thank you. Mr. Petty, I'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Mr. Petty, I'm kind of interested in the last remark Mr. Plater made about the as-applied test. You know, if it's not developed in district court, is it more difficult for us to tackle this issue? What are your thoughts on that?
I don't believe it's difficult for this court to do the analysis because you have the facts. You have the trial transcript. You have the testimony of witnesses. Those are the facts. This is not something where some new set of facts is apparently going to show up if it were to be litigated before the district court judge. Admittedly, the trial attorney below did not raise these issues before trial, before Judge Flanagan. I believe the court can still consider these issues as a matter of plain error, for example, because it is error on its face. This statute is unconstitutional on its face. Even if the court, as I said, doesn't want to consider the constitutional issue, the court can still grant relief to Mr. Rosales because it simply is the case that, I appreciate my friend Mr. Plater's argument that there's an implicit idea that if you make threats to Dick Gammack, government in Washoe County is going to come to a standstill, but that's just simply not the case. And not only that, but it is an empirical fact that nothing happened over 5 years in Washoe County. People can say negative things about Mr. Gammack. People say negative things about Mr. Gammack. Some people even suggest that Mr. Gammack ought to die. But that doesn't mean that they're calling for the overthrow of government of Washoe County. And in this instance, this graffiti, disgusting as it may be with regards to the references to police officers, their kids, and their wives, simply isn't a call for the overthrow of government.
What about the swastikas and all that he was using?
Well, that's symbolic speech. It's protected speech. It doesn't, just because there's a swastika there doesn't necessarily mean you're calling for the overthrow of government. It simply means you may be an adherent to a particular brand of political philosophy that is inconsistent with our democracy, but it doesn't mean you're calling for the overthrow of this organized government. There's no way they can shoehorn these facts into that statute, or as I said in my reply brief, I think, pound the round nail of this statute into the square holes of the facts, or whatever I said, I can't recall. But they just simply, we all know the expression, we know what I'm trying to say. They can't do it. What Mr. Plater argues, essentially, is the collapsing of speech to facts. He says, if you say the word, then it's as good as inciting action, and therefore the statute's been complied with. There is, in fact, conduct with this speech. It's the conduct of moving your mouth. It's the conduct of expressing air through your vocal cords to make a sound. But that's about the extent of the conduct in this particular case. Or, in this case, since it was writing, the conduct was taking, at some point in time, apparently unnoticed by the public, time to go out and write on these walls this offensive behavior. But it isn't language designed to incite anybody. There isn't any evidence in the record there was anybody even present. These writings are all things that were seen after the fact. If I might conclude my comment, I would submit to the court that to the extent that these were of any interest to anyone other than the police, the district attorney, and media, they were observed by members of the public as not terribly compelling graffiti, simply graffiti. Thank you.
Thank you. The panel thanks Mr. Plater and Mr. Petty for their argument, briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted.
Thank you.
Thank you.